Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Alice Henderson is my guest today, and it was her love of wild places, wildlife, science, and suspense that inspired her new thriller series, which began with A Solitude of Wolverines. Today, we're talking about the second in that series with protagonist Alex Carter, who's a wildlife biologist. The book is called A Blizzard of Polar Bears, and it takes place up in Churchill, Manitoba, which is a place I visited, and I found it a really unique, life-changing experience, so I was very excited to find it as a location in a novel. So let me tell you a little bit about my guest. Alice Henderson is a dedicated wildlife researcher. She uses a variety of methods, including bioacoustic studies, to undertake wildlife surveys, determining what species are present on lands that have been set aside for conservation. She's also written media tie-in novels, including official novels for the TV shows Supernatural and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. While working at LucasArts, she wrote material for several Star Wars video games. And in addition to all of that, she's written, I think, 12 or 13 books of her own. Again, this is the second in the Alex Carter series. It's called A Blizzard of Polar Bears. And here's my guest, Alice Henderson. Alice Henderson, welcome. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Vicki. I'm honored to be here.
Well, I'm so pleased to have you here for a number of reasons. You've blended your love of wildlife and science to create the Alex Carter series of books. And I'm dying to talk to you about your latest in the series, A Blizzard of Polar Bears, because it's set in Churchill, Manitoba. And I had a wonderful experience up there with the polar bears and that whole little town. So I'm dying to talk to you about that. But your background is so interesting. I want to share a little of that with our listeners before we dive into the book. So in addition to being a writer, you are fascinated with wildlife. You're involved as a sanctuary monitor for the Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust. You've worked at Lucasfilms. You've done all kinds of things. Where did you start?
I started quite young. Actually, the year I turned 6 was the same year I started writing and the same year I started really being concerned with wildlife and taking up activism and wildlife work. But being 6 with wildlife, there wasn't a lot I could do. As much as I wanted to run off and jump on the Rainbow Warrior and help Greenpeace, I had to come up with my own creative ways to help. So I started, for example, mucking out cages at the local Wildlife Rescue and Rehabilitation Center. And then I would do little crafts, and I would sell them door to door and take that money and donate it to different wildlife nonprofits. So I was really concerned at a very young age. It's when I learned about extinction, and it wasn't something that not just something that happened millions of years ago to the dinosaurs, but it was something happening right now. And I was very concerned about that. And I remember asking my father, "These species are gone forever?" And he said, "Yes." So I was very worried about that. So then as I grew older, I started studying a lot of field zoology and biogeography and things like that in college and in grad school. And then I began working in the field a lot with wildlife. My specialty is bioacoustics. So I set out recorders in the field, and I have an ultrasonic mic that can pick up bats and a regular mic that can pick up audible sounds like wolves, bird song, amphibians, and then I examine these recorders later and I can see what species are using a particular tract of land. You mentioned the Wildlife Land Trust. They have sanctuaries all over the country, and it was interesting to see what threatened or endangered species were using those parcels of land.
Wow, so you get to actually go out to all these places then. And I know you're involved also in mapping, and there's a lot of great pathways that are being created these days for wildlife to cross freeways, for example. We've done a couple of shows on that, and we have some up here in the Seattle area across some of our main major freeways. So this is all great work and so fascinating.
Absolutely, and I'm a partner of the Yellowstone to Yukon Conservation Initiative. Since you mentioned wildlife corridors, they're trying to do a single corridor, one connective piece of land all the way from Yellowstone to the Yukon in Canada. So I've done a mapping for them, and it's such a great project, and they're negotiating with private landowners to allow wildlife to cross as well as connecting public lands.
Hmm. So you've looked at, I mean, you've surveyed all kinds of animals, from grizzlies to wolves, spotted owls, wolverines, which was the subject of your first book in the Alex Carter series, too. I had never seen a wolverine. They're very elusive, right?
They're extremely elusive, yes. There's only about probably less than 300 left in the lower 48 in the United States. And that was a big reason why I chose wolverines for the first book, because a lot of people I'm hearing from readers didn't realize wolverines were a real animal. When they heard that word wolverine, they think Hugh Jackman from the X-Men or the mascot for University of Michigan. So a lot of people have been writing to me saying, I didn't know that they existed, and they're such a neat species, and they're getting hit. They're a large member of the weasel family, and they're just tough as nails. They're amazing. They only weigh about 35 pounds, but they can take on grizzlies and take down moose and drive grizzlies off kills, and they're really hardy creatures, but unfortunately, because of climate change and habitat destruction, they're not doing well.
Hmm. And I was, your first book in the Alex Carter series, just so listeners know, was, I think it was The Solitude of Wolverines, correct?
It is.
Yeah. And I remember reading something along the way, an interview that you had done, where you were talking about how they're pretty vital to our ecology, because they help clean up the forest, for example. And they can, they literally eat anything, right?
They do. They will eat a carcass that is laying out on the forest floor for 3 years. And they eat everything. They even will eat the teeth off a carcass.
Hmm.
And bones, and one researcher actually picked one up, and the tummy was just rattling around with bones. And they also, another important thing they do is they can dig. They're very strong. So in the dead of winter, they can dig up carcasses that are buried, say, beneath an avalanche, and then other species can come along, foxes and other weasels and coyotes, and feed off that carcass as well.
Mm.
So they sort of help feed other animals during the winter.
Yeah. Yeah, so when we talk about these animals dying off and becoming extinct, I mean, it's important to our planet, because everybody has a job to do. So it's very sad, I think, to realize how, I didn't realize how few wolverines there were. So let's dive into the book. And I'm dying to talk about this, A Blizzard of Polar Bears. Would you begin that by giving us a synopsis? It's in the second in the Alex Carter series. So tell us who Alex Carter is and what the story is about.
So Alex Carter is a wildlife biologist, and in the first book, she's in Montana, in rural Montana, looking for wolverines on the site of an old ski resort that there used to be wolverines there, but because of all the recreation, they disappeared. So she's seeing if they're still in the area, or perhaps they've returned to the area now that the ski resort has shut down and donated this massive tract of land to a land trust. So the second book takes place as the last one ends. So she's fresh off her wolverine study, and she gets a gig studying polar bears in the western Hudson Bay in the Canadian Arctic. And there she's embedded with a small team who fly over the vast ice of Hudson Bay in a helicopter, and she sort of leans precariously out of the helicopter with a tranquilizer gun and tags these polar bears, and then they can land and take samples from the polar bear. Its fur, for example, fat samples, look at their teeth and their weight to determine determine how healthy they are. And the study starts out going well, but then things start to go awry. Equipment goes missing. Her helicopter pilot unexpectedly quits. Someone breaks into her lab and steals all the samples she's collected so far. But she's so determined to see this study out and hopefully get stronger protections for polar bears that she goes ahead and she finds a new helicopter pilot. But when that helicopter crashes on the ice and she's stranded out there and armed assailants are moving in, she realizes that someone is actually willing to kill to end her study.
Yes, so you've really combined your love of wildlife and thrillers right there. So that's very appealing to me too, because I love thrillers and wildlife too. So let me ask you about Alex Carter, because she's a strong protagonist. And let's talk about how you developed her and how you wanted her to show up to readers.
I read a lot of thrillers too, and one thing that always struck me, I love reading thrillers that incorporate science. And one thing that really struck me was that often these female characters that were in these science thrillers were very two-dimensional. They would have, say, a job title, but really their main function was to give the male character someone to have a relationship with. And I wanted to create a female character who was very strong, who wasn't defined by her relationship, who could fight and think her way out of situations, who was very resourceful, MacGyver-esque even, and wasn't defined by, say, how attractive she was or her role to other characters.
And I love that, because you're right. They call them strong protagonists, strong female leads. They always have a man attached to them. So I love the approach you took here. So when you're developing a character, if we can go a little bit into the writer's point of view here, how does that begin for you? How did Alex come to you in the beginning?
Well, for years I had been publishing novels and then doing this wildlife work, and it hadn't hit me that I should combine the two. And I was in Montana actually doing a bioacoustic study, hoping to find wolves on a sanctuary. And as I was setting up my recording equipment, and I'm in this wonderfully isolated area, it's remote, and I thought, why aren't I setting a thriller here about a wildlife biologist? And I could bring my love of wildlife and my concern over the plight of wildlife into these thrillers, and I love writing action and suspense sequences. So I thought, okay, I'm going to create a character. And Alex just kind of came to life in my mind that night. I went back to camp, and I thought, I knew I wanted her to be a wildlife biologist. I knew I wanted each book to be about a different species, so I wanted her to be freelance and able to travel. And she just popped in my head. It was such a great experience. You know, sometimes with writing, you're really struggling, and this just all fell together beautifully. And I was just so excited. I actually wrote the first scene that very night for the introduction.
Well, that's great. I want her job. So I'd like to talk a little bit, we'll come back to the story in a bit, but I do want to take advantage of your brain while I've got you here, because, you know, I mentioned the story takes place in Churchill, Manitoba, which is a small town up in Manitoba. When I was up there, it was about 15 years ago, maybe a little longer, and you could only really get there by rail or by small aircraft. So it's quite isolated, and it's such a unique place. And I know you couldn't get there to do the research yourself on foot because of the pandemic. So talk to us a little bit about how you conducted your research about the polar bears and Churchill and all that stuff.
So you're absolutely right, Vicki. I was supposed to go up to Churchill in October of 2020, but when the pandemic hit, I wasn't able to. But thankfully, just before the pandemic, I had been in the Canadian Arctic, but I was on the west side where the Beaufort Sea polar bear population lives. So I was able to spend months up there in the Canadian Arctic, just being in the forest there and up by the Arctic Ocean and just steeping in that atmosphere. And it was such a powerful time. I was so moved and just fell in love with the Canadian Arctic. And with the specifically with the polar bear research that's happening with the Western Hudson Bay polar bears in Churchill, to be sure my science was accurate, I spoke at length to two polar bear researchers who do work in Churchill and tagging polar bears, and went through all the minutiae of that process and how to safely tag polar bears and what kind of samples they take and what kind of tests they then run on the samples and what they can learn from that. And I also talked to them about the helicopter and how they ride in that, what kind of equipment they bring with them. And these storms can move in so fast over the ice that the researchers really have to be prepared to land if they need to and wait out weather or even camp out on the ice if they have to.
Yeah, because I went to a couple of lectures at science research centers up there, and it was just fascinating. They, of course, they also have polar bear jail, which everybody laughs at. But if a polar bear comes into the town, he's put in jail, and then they leave him there for a little bit, and he's carted back out to the wild. So it's such a unique experience. It's very hard to explain to people, I think, you know, what it actually feels like to be there. But it's just such an isolated area. And I think you've really captured that in the book. Let's talk a little bit about the polar bear situation that's going on, because as I mentioned, it was 15 years or so when I was up there. We went in November, like the second week, I think, of November. And we were told, quite frankly, you probably won't see polar bears because they'll be out on the ice, you know, usually in October. But it was the only date we could get, so we thought it was worth the risk. We went up in the second week of November, and I saw 51 or 52 polar bears the very first day because the ice had not frozen over. And you can imagine some of them were quite thin. There were mommy bears trying to feed their babies who were very weak. And now, of course, it's even worse. So talk to us a little bit about what's going on up there and why we should care about it, why people should get more concerned than we appear to be.
It is definitely looking dire for the polar bear. There are 19 subpopulations of polar bears that live in the circumpolar region, so Greenland, Russia, Canada, and Scandinavia. And new studies now, there was just one in the New York Times, that it looks like almost all of these populations will be gone by the end of the century.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking.
It really is. And as you mentioned, the ice, it's forming, because of global warming, the ice is forming much, much later in the season and breaking up much, much earlier. And polar bears really rely on winters and sea ice to be able to hunt seals from these platforms, these ice platforms. And with the ice not there for much of the winter, they're forced to starve. Polar bears normally starve during the summer months. But because this hunting, seal hunting season is shorter and shorter for them, they're forced to starve for longer and longer. And the mother bears, and they don't have cubs every year, they have cubs every 3 years minimum, and they can't feed their cubs. They run out of milk, and so the cub mortality rate is going up. And with as slow as they reproduce as it is, and it's just not looking good, and they are forced to shore where there's not as much nutritious food, and especially fat-concentrated food.
Yeah, they. I was watching the David Attenborough. I loved David Attenborough. Well, still do. I shouldn't say loved. He's still here, doing great work still. So polar bears spend over 50% of their time hunting for food, and they might only catch one or two of the 10 seals they try to catch, depending on, you know, a bunch of variables. They really rely on that sea ice, as you said, of course, to get their food. But what surprised me was that he said the younger, smaller bears don't have the energy, obviously, of the big male bears. And every single day they're without food, they lose nearly a kilo in weight, or 2.2 pounds a day without food, for every day they're without food. So they can very quickly lose half their body weight, which could be very detrimental.
Absolutely. And they're challenged not only by this ability to hunt and the loss of fat and body weight, but there are a lot of environmental pollutants that have worked their way into polar bear bodies, which can be a detriment to their immune system. And then, of course, they're passing, the mother bears can pass these pollutants onto their cubs. For example, heavy metals like mercury, you know, we've heard that human women who are pregnant shouldn't eat fish, and it's the same for polar bears. Heavy metals like mercury, industrial chemicals that humans put into the atmosphere, they all work their way. There's this process, biomagnification, where the chemicals will work into the sea, for example, and the plankton eat it, and then fish eat the plankton, and then seals eat the fish, and every time it goes up one tier in the food chain, the pollutants get more and more concentrated. So by the time the polar bear is eating a seal, that seal has so much concentrated pollutants in it that then that is what the bear is intaking.
Oh, wow. Wow. So a healthy bear should weigh about 800 to 1,300 pounds. You don't realize how big they are until you see them out in the wild. It's. I remember we were out on the tundra in one of those tundra buggies, and we were watching a mother with her two cubs, and it's just beautiful to see them. It's life-changing, I think, to see something like that in the wild. And all of a sudden, she got very nervous, and she just nudged her cubs and took off as fast as she could, which was not very fast because she was quite weak by that point through lack of food. And eventually we realized, you know, there must be a male around. She can smell a male coming. And sure enough, he came over a mound of snow, and he was enormous, absolutely enormous. So it's just magnificent to see them out. And I think, you know, I don't know, what are your views on ecotourism? Because there's pluses and minuses to it, as I see.
I agree. I mean, it's good to have people. You asked earlier about, how do we get people to care, or why should they care? And ecotourism is one way. When people see these magnificent animals out in the wild, they can form a connection or a bond to them and grow to care about their conservation. And I think in that way it's good. And then in other ways, if it gets too out of control and habitat's being trampled, for example, or there's too much human traffic and the wildlife can't go about their normal routine, then it can be on the dangerous side.
Mm.
But I think in response to your question about why should we care, it's an interesting anthropocentric way that I think humans sometimes look at animals, like, what use is this animal to us, and why should I care about it? And I think one thing that people forget is how connected everything is. And one great example I can think of is that when they reintroduced wolves into Yellowstone, it changed the course of the rivers.
Oh, that's interesting. How did that happen?
Well, the elk population had exploded in the park, and the elk were overbrowsing all the willows on the shores of the rivers. And so when they reintroduced the wolves, the elk population was held in check and was much more healthy, and they weren't overbrowsing on the willows, mm-hmm. which allowed the rivers to return to their former pathways. And so everything is so connected, and I think people think, well, if this species disappears, how does that affect me? And I don't think we're realizing the huge ripple effect that when one species disappears, it creates a vacuum. For example, we were talking about the wolverine earlier. If the wolverine isn't there to dig up these carcasses, then that's going to affect the health of these other animals trying to survive the long winters. And it all has this cascading effect, and we're all part of that, humans, and we will be affected as well, even though we're not looking at the clear from A to B, if the species disappears, this is how it's going to affect us.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think nature is so amazing. We take it so much for granted, but, I mean, these animals, you know, they're up in the Arctic, and they're created to be up there. I read they have three eyelids, because the third eyelid helps protect the bear's eyes from the elements. So nature prepares for them. It puts them where they need to be. Their feet are so huge. I mean, we know that, but they act as a natural snowshoe. They're 30 centimeters wide, typically, I read, the size of a dinner plate. So, I mean, that's a big foot, right? So, yeah, and I didn't know this, I didn't really think about it, I guess. Their fur is transparent, black skin, blue tongue, and 4 inches of fat underneath the bear's skin to keep it warm. So, some fun facts there.
And they have special little pads on their feet to keep them from slipping on the ice, too.
Yeah, just and nature is just amazing how it accommodates everything here. So one of the things we can do is, you know, we can't all be David Attenborough or, you know, somebody who's making a huge difference, but we can be more aware of local organizations. And I know at the back of your book, you do have a list of resources if we're interested in getting more involved in wildlife and activity. But let's go back to the book. One of the things I am always fascinated by is what kind of scenes authors like to write and don't, you know, what do you struggle with? What do you really enjoy writing?
I love action scenes and fight scenes.
Is that revealing? Or
And the parts that I don't like writing the most are the mundane, like if she's going to change her address at the post office or something like that. So often when I'm writing, I might just put a placeholder for a mundane scene. Like, she goes to the post office and changes her address and goes to get groceries. And then I'll jump back into the action scene. And then when I go through the manuscript for the second time, I'll fill in all those little mundane placeholders. And if I know I've got an action scene coming up to write, that's just the best feeling. And I usually just sit down and write, and hours will go by, and I won't even realize it.
So, right. When you're writing a series, it's important that the character has some evolution. I think maybe not too much, because often readers don't like it when there's too much evolution there. But how do you keep somebody like Alex Carter, the biologist, the protagonist in your series, how do you keep her interesting and evolving without too much change there?
I think that she's getting more and more fired up as the books progressed about conservation and about realizing the monumental fight ahead of her. And I think she's losing some of her naivety about how people might perceive, say, land trusts and not in a welcoming way. And I think she's also coming to terms with the fact that this lifestyle she's chosen, being out in the middle of nowhere, often alone, means that her social life is going to be sparse. And it's something she struggles with, you know, she wants to connect with people, but not only is she working in these remote places, often alone, but she finds it difficult to relate to people who don't care about conservation the way she does. So I think as the books progress, she's really growing and sort of accepting that about herself and figuring out how she can balance the two, this desire to have connection in her life, but at the same time be true to her mission.
Well, it's a human thing. I mean, and it's one of the reasons I asked you, you know, how do we get people to care? Why should people care about this situation? Because, you know, people are busy and there's so much sensory overload and there's so much focus on instant gratification today. So it all gets in the way of this. I want to throw a couple of words at you if I can. And as a writer, I wonder, put your writer hat on as you're answering these, if you would, Alice. So tell us what discipline means to you.
To me, discipline means writing every day on a deadline. And I sit down, I know I want to have a minimum amount of words done. I show up, I do the work, and I've never missed a deadline. So I'm very aware of, like, sometimes writing can come, it can be difficult, the words can come hard, but I have to get a certain amount of words done every single day.
Good.
No matter what.
Good. And what does creativity mean to you?
Creativity to me is imagination and anything's possible. That's my favorite stage in writing a book. It's the very beginning when the characters are taking shape and I'm not sure where I'm going to set it or what species I'm going to write about. And and I'm just abuzz and with this feeling of creativity and everything's coming together. And just always being on the lookout. There's so many things that inspire me, and so I'm constantly making little notes and thinking of ways to bring scenes to life.
Yeah, it's one of the great things about being a writer is you're always curious, you know, always curious. What about success? How do you define success as a writer?
Personally, for me, if I earned enough money that I could buy connective lands for wildlife, and, you know, that would be the ultimate success for me.
Well, that's a pretty awesome goal to have. And so I love that you have, in A Blizzard of Polar Bears, you've, you know, connected the science with a novel, because I think oftentimes, you know, people don't want to read a nonfiction book on it, but putting it through your art, if you will, through a novel is a good way of raising awareness. So job well done.
Thank you so much. You know, I thought about that. If I wrote a nonfiction book, say about wolverines, probably the only people that would read it are people that are already aware of the plight of Wolverine.
Yeah.
But by writing a suspense novel, I hope that people would pick up the book for the suspense and action and then just fall in love with these creatures like I have.
Hmm. And, you know, as a writer, I think every time you write a new novel or a new large piece, you grow as a writer. How do you feel you've grown as a writer in the writing of A Blizzard of Polar Bears?
As a writer, I feel more confident about meeting deadlines, especially tight deadlines, and these books have a lot of research obviously involved with them, and I feel like I've smoothed out my process of incorporating all of this research into these suspense scenes so that it's not overladen with science where people are going to be checked out or be pulled out of the narrative and when they want to read it for the action, for example. So I feel like I'm growing in terms of being able to balance those two a little better.
Well, Alice Henderson, it's been a great pleasure talking with you. I know listeners can find out much more about you at your website, alicehenderson.com. And, you know, thank you for the work that you're doing for wildlife and conservation, as well as readers. And final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
I would encourage people, you know, I hear from a lot of people that they care about wildlife, they care about climate change, but they just feel so hopeless that or busy that they don't feel like they themselves can make much of a difference. And I just want to encourage people that they absolutely can make a difference. I mean, especially right now, for example, with Congress deciding about climate change legislation, write to your representatives and let them know it's important to you.
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of things you can do in your own life. Like, for example, just simply eat less meat. You know, have a meatless Sunday with your family, for example. And also engaging in citizen science. If people are intrigued by wildlife, there's all kinds of great projects you can do, even from your computer. You know, you can look at rhinos, for example, in Africa and help scientists count them. Or you can go out in the field and count monarch butterflies and contribute that way. So there's a lot of ways to kind of get out of that hopeless rut, and I hope people will take action in their personal lives to do that.
Oh, that's great advice. Thank you so much, Alice Henderson, for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Vicky. This was a real honor.
And the book, again, is called A Blizzard of Polar Bears. My guest, Alice Henderson, and this is the second in the Alex Carter series. She's a wildlife biologist. And the first book was A Solitude of Wolverines. So I want to thank everyone for being with us today. Questions, comments, or feedback on today's show, you can find me through our website at conversationslive.net, conversationslive.net. So please join us next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.